Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 2021 has been a huge year for the labor movement. There have been almost 1,000 strikes and protests this year, according to a Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations tracker. Thousands of workers have successfully fought for better pay, benefits, and working conditions. Last week, workers in Buffalo, New York, formed the first unionized Starbucks coffee shop in the country. Starbucks workers in other cities are now filing to unionize. Yesterday, workers at Wirecutter reached a deal with their owner, the New York Times, for a contract that would guarantee wage increases. Wirecutter is a product review website. The Wirecutter union went on strike during Black Friday through Cyber Monday, which is the site's most profitable days of the year. Hundreds of Frito-Lay workers in Kansas, more than 1,000 Nabisco workers across five states, and 10,000 John Deere workers all walked off the job this year, demanding wage increases and better working conditions. 1,400 Kellogg's workers at cereal plants in Nebraska, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Tennessee have been on strike for more than 2 months. When the union recently rejected a deal, Kellogg said it will permanently replace those workers. And over 1,000 coal miners in Alabama have been on strike since April 1st. This is just a taste of what is happening across the country. Workers say that they are tired of companies putting profits before basic dignity. So what has worked this year and what is in store for 2022? Joining us now are two guests. Stephen Greenhouse is a longtime labor reporter who previously covered labor with the New York Times. Stephen Greenhouse is author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Hi, Stephen. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be here, Rose.
Great to have you. Dr. Lane Windham is a longtime labor organizer and labor historian. She's associate director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University, where she directs Will Empower, a project that promotes women's leadership in the labor movement and the struggle for economic justice. Dr. Windham is the author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s and the Roots of a New Economic Divide. Hi, Lane. Thank you so much for joining us.
Rose, it's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. When you take a look at the ILR School Labor Action Tracker, I mean, there's 990 strikes and protests this year. It's just incredible to go down this list. I mean, Portland Community College, a lot of these things we haven't even heard of. Raven Software, Abarta, Coca-Cola Beverages, Daily Hampshire Gazette. I mean, the list goes on and on. So Lane, when you look back at the year, what really stands out for you?
Yeah, we have seen a lot of worker activity, a lot of agitation. I think that you really could call it a kind of worker rights revival. And I think the pandemic is at the heart of it. The pandemic really changed what people expect out of a job, what they're even willing to accept from a job. And there's just a lot more public awareness about how poorly workers have been treated during the pandemic, but also for years. So you see that many more workers are striking. There's a lot of organizing, which you've covered at Starbucks and elsewhere. But, you know, people are also pushing back and voting with their feet and staying home. They're refusing to take the bad jobs. They're quitting at a high rate. I see that as all part of the same thing, which is that people are reevaluating their work experience because of the pandemic and are deciding they want more voice or they want more out of their work experience.
What about you, Stephen? What stands out for you when you look back on the year?
Several things, Rose. I mean, I agree with what Lane said, but I think in many ways, the pandemic over the past 2 years really shined a very, very bright light on how lousy working conditions are for many workers. And many workers were very scared to do anything about it. But I think the pandemic really emboldened them for two reasons. One, you know, the white collar workers at their company we're working comfortably at home, pulling in $150,000, $200,000 a year, while the essential workers, you know, who work, who drive the buses, who work at the checkout counters, who are delivering food, you know, they're risking their lives every day as essential workers. And they felt they weren't appreciated enough. They felt their companies didn't do enough to protect them. And, you know, one of the things that shocked me about the pandemic was how few companies gave hero pay, hazard pay to the workers to reward them for, you know, doing this dangerous work every day going on. I think, you know, so they, when they were discussing raises, when they're discussing contract negotiations, even when, if they weren't unionized and just felt they were getting a raw deal, that's why we've seen so many workers walk out, go on strike, protest this year. They felt they gave their all, they risked their lives, and they felt far too often employers did not begin to treat them as well as they thought they should. And then, aside from that, there was this other loud statement of, you know, from workers about how unhappy they are with their jobs. That's the so-called Great Resignation, where in recent months, Rose, a record 4.3 million workers voluntarily quit their jobs each month, the highest numbers in American history. And that shows just a whole bunch of American workers feel that they weren't paid enough, that they weren't treated well enough. And with this labor shortage, they felt this is a good opportunity to kind of, you know, shove it to the boss and go look for a better job elsewhere. So we're seeing a lot of worker anger. They've been emboldened and angered by the pandemic, and they also see these rare opportunities because of this labor shortage.
Lane, can you also talk about the effect of inequality on workers and what, how that has really sparked a lot of these strikes and protests? I did a little research on the Starbucks CEO, Kevin Johnson. In 2020, he took home almost $15 million in salary and stock awards. And in 2019, he was given a $50 million bonus based on the company's shareholder return performance between 2019 and 2022. So $50 million just in a bonus. And yet Starbucks just recently announced that workers will finally make $15 an hour and maybe a little bit more for people who've been there for 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, Rose, I think you're exactly right. This has been a long time coming, right? Our entire employment system, our economy in many ways, has long rested on a low wage, no benefits model that has decimated people, their families, their communities. You know, for 40 years, we've had an economy where employers could reliably get workers for extraordinarily low wages. And I think that that's starting to change. I agree with Steve that, during the pandemic, we celebrated essential workers. We banged pots and pans for them, right? And then they had to go back to the same dead end, low wage jobs while the elite at the top made money hand over fist, and their earnings and wealth soared. And I think people are really pushing back. A lot of economists talk about a labor shortage, but I think we should call it what it is, which is this is a slow moving general strike. I think that people are just not accepting these low wage, no benefit jobs anymore that leave them feeling so burned out and insecure. They're looking at their options and they are waiting their employers out.
What are your thoughts on this, Stephen? Going back to Starbucks, fourth quarter net revenue was up 31% to $8 billion. I mean, corporate profits are so incredibly high right now, and yet people are still working three jobs just to make ends meet.
So there are some surprising things that, you know, Starbucks does treat, just generally pay its workers, give far better benefits than, say, McDonald's or Burger King or Taco Bell. But its workers felt, you know, this is a supposedly progressive company, and they're just not treating us as nicely as they should. And we've been understaffed hugely during the pandemic. And we're still struggling to get by, even though maybe our wages are a few dollars more than at McDonald's. And, you know, again, pushed by the pandemic and having, you know, the most pro-union president in decades and things like that, I think the Starbucks workers really felt it's time to stand up and, you know, let's try to unionize. And the victory last Thursday in Buffalo is a big deal. It's the first of 8,947 company-owned Starbucks in the United States to unionize. And that's a big deal. And suddenly, you know, workers at two Starbucks right outside Boston have filed a petition for unionization elections. So things are moving, and you know, the Starbucks victory for labor could really be an opportunity for the AFL-CIO, for the Service Employees Union, for unions around the country to really say, this is an important moment. You know, we really see that many service sector workers, fast food workers, low-wage workers have it bad, and we should jump on this opportunity that we have from Starbucks in Buffalo to encourage, you know, workers at Starbucks across the country, then after that, maybe other fast food restaurants and restaurants to unionize. This is an opportunity. And I think in ways there's some exaggeration about, you know, the importance of, you know, yes, there was an upsurge in strikes this year, but when you compare it with, you know, 10 and 20 and 30 and 40, 50 years ago, there's still not nearly as much labor activity as there was. But there was an important awakening of labor during the pandemic. And now the question is whether organizers and unions can really figure out ways to build it into a lasting, stronger workers' movement.
Stephen, what really strikes you about the vote to unionize the Starbucks coffee shop in Buffalo, New York? How did the workers there do it?
Several ways. I was working on a piece comparing it with the union's loss at Amazon, and it's easier to win at a workplace of 30 workers than an Amazon warehouse of 5,000 workers. And you know, but I think there are a lot of the workers at Starbucks are educated. They're kind of countercultural. They want to stick it to the man. And so I think they're more willing to unionize in the first instance. But for me, the thing that kind of most surprised me is that Starbucks, just like Amazon, ran this incredibly aggressive anti-union campaign. They brought in all these managers from around the United States to work inside the three Starbucks where they're going to be union votes. And those managers, those executives are working alongside the workers, kind of spying on them. The workers said intimidating them, and there were all these anti-union meetings, and even the president of Starbucks North American retail operations was working in these stores alongside the workers, making workers feel very uptight and scared to talk. And despite all that, even Howard Schultz came to Buffalo and gave a big anti-union speech to the workers. Despite all that, the union won. I think partly because, you know, the workers, you know, just were tired of being pushed around. There was a wonderful organizer, Richard Benziger, who used to be the AFL-CIO's organizing director. And also, you know, during the Amazon unionization effort in Alabama, it was really during the height of the pandemic, and it was really scary for people to talk face to face. It was hard to get inside, impossible to get inside the Amazon warehouse to speak to workers. I think at Starbucks they had much more access to the workers, and I think there was very smart worker-to-worker organizing. You know, on Twitter, you see many of the Starbucks workers were happy to go on and provide information and tell people what was happening, and there were a lot of very brave, smart, rank-and-file worker leaders there that I think played a key difference. And as Elaine will be quick to note, many of them were courageous women, and they really led the way.
Lane, what would you add? What really strikes you about the successful effort to unionize Starbucks in Buffalo?
Well, Steve is right. I think that, certainly the women's leadership was key. I'm also really struck by young people's interest in unions and labor. The most recent Gallup polling, of course, shows that a 68% approval rating of unions, the highest since 1965. It's even higher among young people. 77% of young people between the ages of 18 and 34 say that they support a union. And you just are seeing this not only in Starbucks, but in lots of organizing efforts and strikes across the country. Not only have workers formed a union at Starbucks in Buffalo. But just this week, 77 workers at Spruce Coffee in Boulder, Colorado, formed a union, as well as coffee shop workers at Diesel, Forge, and Block in Boston. Those don't have the same name as Starbucks, but there's lots of organizing, and lots of that is young people, including we've seen organizing at the Art Institute of Chicago, at museums in New York and elsewhere. Lots of journalists have been forming unions this year, including a lot of young people. And so that's a trend that I am keeping a close eye on, is young people's willingness to take on the boss and to organize. And what's so interesting is, even though young people are doing something new and seeing things in a new way, the employers are not reacting in a new way. They are pulling the same old playbook off the shelf, you know, and basically busting unions. They are doing the same thing they've been doing for 40 years, forcing people into mandatory attendance meetings, trying to intimidate people, harass people. And what you saw in Buffalo is that those young workers stood up to that.
Can I just jump in a sec?
Please.
So Lane makes an excellent point. So, you know, these are mainly young workers who are unionizing. And, you know, that Gallup poll was really fascinating. 77% of young people support unions. And I think there really is a lot of upset among your young workers, you know, non-white collar workers, about how they've been treated. And, you know, they see inflation is high. They have, you know, ridiculous amounts of student loans. They can't afford rents, with rents skyrocketing. And they've grown fed up and they want change. And a lot of them have been influenced by Bernie Sanders and AOC and the Fight for 15. And they're like, why should we sit on our hands and stand for all this poor treatment? It's really time for change. And that's why we're seeing, you know, a lot of discontent among young workers. You know, 600 workers at the Art Institute of Chicago are voting whether to unionize. That would be a huge union victory. I'm in New York City, a few blocks away, Columbia University, 3,000 graduate students are fed up. They say, you know, they've been on strike for a few weeks. You know, Columbia's endowment has soared from $11 billion to $14 billion. And these grad student workers who teach classes are saying, it's crazy. Many of us are only getting $29,000 a year and we can't afford dental work. You know, why isn't rich Columbia treating us younger workers the way we deserve? And I think, you know, so a lot of these, you know, people at 25, 27 today kind of came of age during the horrible 2008, 2009 recession, and they think there's something wrong with our economy. I think that's why a lot of them kind of lean progressive, lean left, and sympathize with unions and wanting to do something. So there really is this unusual opportunity in many ways, you know, for workers to organize and demand change.
Lane, you brought up young people. Can you tell us what young people think about unions these days, and where do they get their information about what a workplace is supposed to be like?
Well, I hope that you'll ask a young person that, because I certainly don't want to speak for them. But, you know, I recently learned about the Reddit subgroup anti-work, which is apparently blowing up with people posting like their resignation letters and their resignation tweets to their boss. And this is the place where I don't know if you followed when at Kellogg, the company basically said it was going to hire permanent replacements when the workers voted down the most recent contract. And young people through this Reddit subgroup flooded Kellogg with fake job applications and basically swamped their system so that they couldn't actually hire any striker replacements. So there's a sort of zeitgeist among young people, a culture, I think, that is valuing collective action around surviving and dealing with this economy. And it is very different than what I grew up in. It's very different than anything I saw as a young union organizer. Richard Bensinger actually said, and he's a longtime union organizer. He was working with the Starbucks workers. He said that was the sort of hottest shop, the most interested shop he had seen of recently of workers to form a union. And that really says something. I think we are in a moment. We are truly in a moment.
The other thing, Stephen, to talk about benefits, pensions, healthcare. So my dad recently had a major surgery, and he was a sheet metal worker. He had an incredible union. He told me that in the 70s, they went on strike and got a $12 an hour raise on top of what they were already making in the 70s. And I've been taking care of him over the last few months, thanks to his union. I mean, I don't have to worry about him. I mean, obviously health, yes, but in terms of what's covered, his pension, he has a benefits card. So if things cost money out of pocket, he can use the benefits card thanks to the sheet metal union. And it really hit me because a lot of us are not going to have that when we get older.
That unfortunately is true. And that's great about your father's union. To repeat what many of us know, unfortunately, over the past decade or two, companies have focused humongously on maximizing their profits. And many see the main way to do that is squeezing their workers, freezing wages, reducing health benefits, getting rid of traditional pensions and replacing them with what are often lousy 401ks. 2008, I wrote a book about this called Tough Times for the American Worker that talked about this crazy disconnect where company profits are soaring, the stock market's soaring, productivity per worker is soaring, yet wages are flat, they're falling behind inflation, and companies were pushing relentlessly to reduce health benefits, to get rid of pensions, to maybe reduce vacation days, reduce the number of sick days. And, that book came out 13 years ago. And unfortunately, in many ways, that trend has continued. So fewer and fewer workers have the good pension that your father and my father had and my mother had as well. And again, if there is any silver lining in this damn pandemic, it's that workers have their power has increased because many companies can't find enough workers. So workers are demanding more. And also many workers feel we risked our lives every day while you white collar workers work at home in absolute safety. And you CEOs are taking, insane pay increases while we're, just risking our lives every day. And that's really emboldened people to demand more. Now, a big question, and I talked to economists about this, is whether this surge in worker power that we're seeing right now is going to translate into long-term improvements in wages and in benefits. Now, we've seen several companies move to $14, $15, $16 an hour, and that's great. And I doubt they'll roll them back. But I don't think I don't think we've seen many meaningful increases in worker benefits. And let's hope we see more of them, and let's hope that I'm hoping that one result of the pandemic and the great resignation and the labor shortage is that, companies will kind of move up, 10 to 20, 30% in generally how they treat workers across the board, because I think a lot of employers are discovering, hey, our workers are humongously unhappy. They're leaving to go elsewhere. Corporate executives look themselves in the mirror and say, hey, I probably didn't treat my workers as well as I should have, and let's try to do a better job moving forward. I think some CEOs will definitely think that. Question is whether many CEOs will think that and act on that.
We're going to take a quick break. That is Stephen Greenhouse, a longtime labor reporter. We're also joined by Dr. Lane Wyndham, a longtime labor organizer and labor historian. On today's Your Call, we are talking about the fight for workers' rights in 2021 and the path ahead. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about the fight for workers' rights in 2021 and the path ahead. And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you've been involved in any strikes or labor protests this year, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you just have any comments about where we are when it comes to workers' rights, you can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Stephen Greenhouse is a longtime labor reporter who previously covered these issues at the New York Times. He's the author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Dr. Lane Windham is a longtime labor organizer and labor historian. Dr. Windham is associate director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown, where she directs Will Empower, a project that promotes women's leadership in the labor movement. She's the author of Knocking on Labor's Door, Union Organizing in the 1970s and the Roots of a New Economic Divide. Before we take calls and emails, I just want to ask you both about how the shareholder slash investor economy has really changed things, because I was struck by a CNBC headline, and this is really the headline anytime a major corporation decides to increase wages. Starbucks CEO defends wage hikes as stock falls 7% on coffee chain's weak earnings outlet, even though the company announced an $8 billion in fourth quarter revenue. The investors were not happy that Starbucks said that they were going to pay their workers a minimum of $15 an hour. So, Stephen, you've been writing about these issues for a long time. How has the investor class really affected all of this?
It's affected all this hugely. I and many others have written about how the United States went from what we used to call managerial capitalism, where, you know, the presidents, the CEOs of companies really called the shots, and, you know, the headquarters was, you know, 50 yards across from the factory, and the CEO and the workers lived in the same town, and the CEO, you know, kind of tried to, you know, felt, you know, I work alongside these people, you know, we should pay them well, we should treat them better. And they didn't have, he didn't have, it was a he, you know, shareholders breathing down his back every day if he paid workers supposedly too much. In the 1980s, 1990s, we saw something called the creation of financial capitalism in the United States, where we saw all these mutual funds and hedge funds and private equity funds that bought up shares of many, of, you know, thousands of companies and became the dominant shareholders. So Wall Street firms, big investors were kind of pressuring CEOs that you better maximize profits. And I don't care, you know, and you know, corporate headquarters increasingly moved away from the factories, and you know, we saw more gated communities where CEOs lived and they didn't have much to do with the workers anymore. So with financial capitalism, there's been much more emphasis on profit maximization. And as I said a few minutes ago, that often translated into freezing wages, pressuring down on health and pension benefits and many other benefits. Now, an interesting thing happened, you know, so 2 years ago, the Business Roundtable, an association of about 180 CEOs of the largest companies, issued the statement saying, you know, we've made a mistake. Corporate America should not focus exclusively on maximizing profits. That's been a mistake. We shall henceforth focus on serving all stakeholders, including workers and communities and the environment. And this was front page news everywhere. People thought this, that corporate America was moving to this new, more enlightened stage. Yet, you know, we look at how corporations treated workers during the pandemic and how CEOs continue to, you know, grab huge salaries, and how, you know, company after company after company still squeezes its workers and tries to focus on maximizing profits. So, you know, I think companies really have not moved, American companies have really not moved away from, you know, their desire to maximize profits and squeeze workers. And that's very unfortunate. And that's why, as Lane and others said, is why so many workers are fed up and standing up and saying and shouting, we want something better.
I know you both need to go. Final thoughts, Stephen, what's in store for 2022?
So I think With the pandemic continuing and many workers continuing to risk their lives and many companies still short of workers, I think many workers will feel emboldened and will continue to see many walkouts and protests and strikes. You know, this is very encouraging for those who want to, you know, improve wages, improve living standards for workers. But I think, you know, it really needs to reach the next level. And I think institutions like the AFL-CIO and many unions have to figure out ways to turn these protests by 100 workers here and 300 workers there into a mass movement to really build worker power and strengthen unions and, you know, try to challenge this whole notion of, you know, profit maximization uber alles.
Lane, sorry, I know we kept you on a little bit longer. Your final thoughts? Where do you see this movement going?
Well, I agree with Steve. I think that we'll see more action, more activity, certainly more strikes and organizing in 2022. But I also think that this sort of slow-moving general strike that we've been living through will continue. It's no coincidence that the jobs that are having the hardest time hiring and keeping workers in service and retail are occupations that are majority women. And women have had a particularly hard time in this pandemic, dealing with childcare issues, dealing with elder care issues. And I don't see those really being solved. And so I anticipate that we will continue to see lots of workers striking, but also opting out and staying home.
Well, Lane, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Lane Wyndham is a longtime labor organizer and labor historian, and we're definitely going to do a show about the women who are accusing so many companies of not taking sexual harassment seriously. At McDonald's, just yesterday, six women sued Tesla, alleging sexual harassment in their factory, as Elon Musk was named the Person of the Year by Time magazine. So we'll definitely do a show about that. Stephen, do you have a few more minutes to stick with us?
Sure. Yeah.
A few callers. Great. Thank you. Let's go to Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. Thank you so much for this show. It's just been inspiring and beautiful. I'm a retiree from San Francisco City and County. Do you hear my radio in the other room? Is it bothering you?
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
Okay. And I'm an SEIU 10 to 1. We have real pensions with... Hello?
Oh, go ahead,
real
Judy.
Pensions with defined benefits and so on. what I wanted to tell you, and one more thing about the Kellogg workers, there is a GoFundMe campaign for their strike fund, so you can contribute to that. but what I wanted to alert people to is this horrid, heinous campaign by the Freedom Foundation. I'm sure Dr. Greenhouse knows all about, you know, who's behind that. I know the Koch brothers and many others. They are sending out mailers to members of my union, SEIU 10 to 1, city workers, Christmas mailers, saying, wouldn't you like $1,200 more this Christmas to buy your gifts or to, you know, whatever. And, you know, these little red and green chipper mailers telling people to drop their union membership. Because of the Janus decision, which took away what kind of made government workers right to work.
And wow. Thank you for the call. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we have to let Stephen go in a minute. I just want to make sure we have time to get another call, and then we'll get Stephen's response. And please email us with info about this, Judy, and maybe we can do a show about it. Let's hear from Bruce in Piedmont. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah. Hello.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yes. I wanted to ask your guest about the law of unintended consequences. In the springtime, COVID forced lots of businesses to shut down, and the Democrats thankfully passed the emergency payments so that people could still survive. But those emergency payments, maybe they have enabled more and more people to do the great resignation now and create the labor shortage that's raising wages. well, that's all well and good, but raising the wages now is causing inflation. And the Republicans are glamming onto that inflation. And I fear that they're going to get a lot of working people voting for them because they don't like the inflation, which has been caused by all those previous things. And I'd like to hear Stephen's reaction to that.
All right. Thanks, Bruce. Sure. Stephen?
Okay, so Bruce, good question, but I think people who blame higher wages for inflation at this instance are wrong. You know, you read the articles, you speak to economists, you know, they say the main reason for the burst in inflation right now is one, higher in oil and gas prices, two, a shortage of automobiles because of this crazy shortage of computer chips. Three, there's the supply. You know, many workers are not showing up to work here and in factories in China and elsewhere, and that's caused a huge shortage of products, of goods, and that's pushed up inflation. And four, because of the generous benefits both the Trump administration and the Biden administration voted, you know, approved for workers. Workers had a lot of money in their pockets, and they weren't spending money at restaurants. They were spending money on you know, new couches and new TVs, and that pushed up inflation for many goods. So there are many unfortunate reasons for inflation. It's not Joe Biden's fault, and it's not higher wages' fault. There are many, you know, many problems. You know, OPEC's oil prices, the supply chain problems. So, you know, that hopefully inflation will come down over the next few months. But higher wages for workers are not causing it. Generally, you know, wage increases have been trailing behind the 6%, 7% inflation rate. And as for the first question, yes, this Freedom Foundation, which is funded by the Koch brothers and other right-wing billionaires, is eager to weaken labor unions. And it's all part of a conservative right-wing billionaire's efforts to weaken unions because they hate unions. You know, as I explained in my book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Workers, there is a bigger anti-union movement in the United States than in any other advanced industrial nation, whether Britain or France or Japan or Germany or Italy. And you know, companies are very anti-union, billionaires are very anti-union, and the Koch brothers want to weaken unions, you know, because unions, you know, push for better social benefits, better social security, better health coverage, you know, more money for childcare. And that might mean a fairer society, and it might also mean higher taxes. And God forbid the Koch brothers and their conservative friends don't want to pay higher taxes. And the other reason the Koch brothers and other conservatives underwrite the Freedom Foundation is they want to weaken unions, especially government employee unions. I mean, they want to encourage workers to stop being members of unions. They want to encourage workers to stop paying dues to the unions because that will weaken the unions and that will make them less powerful in bargaining and less powerful in politics. And the Koch brothers and others realize that, you know, public sector unions often support Democrats, and they figure that if they can cut off public sector unions at the knees, that will really hurt Democrats because it will really cripple or weaken an important supporter of the Democratic Party. So the Freedom Foundation, they say, oh, we're all for freedom. We're all for freedom. We're all for workers' rights. But, you know, they're not going to push for higher minimum wage. They're not going to push for better pensions. They're not going to push for more, you know, OSHA doing a better job ensuring worker safety. They don't care about worker rights. What they really care about is weakening unions so that business and you know, conservatives have a much freer rein in running society.
Well, thank you for those calls. And Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. Stephen Greenhouse is a longtime labor reporter who covered these issues for the New York Times. He's the author of Beaten Down, Worked Up. And thank you for sticking with us for a few more minutes, Stephen.
Always nice to be on your show, and keep healthy and keep up the good work, as I say to friends.
Yes, you too. Thank you so much. We look forward to having you on in the new year.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Okay. Happy New Year. On today's Your Call, we are talking about the fight for workers' rights in 2021 and the path ahead. And joining us now is Colleen McCullen, a barista at a Starbucks location in Buffalo. Colleen has been working there since July and is organizing with the Starbucks Workers United movement. Hi, Colleen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be speaking with you today.
Well, it's an honor to have you. What was your reaction when workers in Buffalo formed the first unionized Starbucks coffee shop?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, I was so lucky that this happened on my birthday. So I cannot imagine a better birthday present than the first unionized Starbucks in America. I think that for me personally, it was inspirational. It was a morale boost that was very much needed. And it gave me, you know, the kick that I needed to keep fighting for unionizing.
What are you hearing from other Starbucks workers in the area about all of these efforts and this one finally success story in Buffalo, New York?
You know, I think that we all just feel that overwhelming sense of we can accomplish so many great things when we stand together and when we advocate for one another. You know, I go into work and we're smiling, we're happy that we know that, you know, we have the power when we unionize to bargain with these corporate corporations and be successful.
Can you tell us what you do at Starbucks and what an average day is like?
Oh, absolutely. So I am a barista at Starbucks. And while I absolutely love making beverages for our customers, I think it's important to also note that we do a lot more than just make coffee. We memorize hundreds of recipes. We make typically we make about two drinks at a time for our customers. We haul heavy buckets of ice. We clean floors. We clean bathrooms. And that's sort of an average day. It's very exciting for me as a barista because I go in every day knowing that that day is going to be a little bit different. It's going to be challenging and it's going to allow me to, you know, grow in my skills.
What sort of schedule do you have at Starbucks? Is it consistent?
Unfortunately, it's not as consistent as maybe some partners would like. You are able to give Starbucks an availability. It has to be given in 3 weeks' notice, and then they move from that availability. However, my hours are always dynamic. They're always changing. With the increase in our union efforts, Starbucks has also been hiring many new partners into our stores, which unfortunately has cut my hours significantly. So it's honestly, Rose, it changes every day. It changes week to week. I have a new schedule.
Do you have any say in all of this? Because that's, I mean, what so many workers are saying is that they want a seat at the table to be able to express their views to management. So what is that situation like for you and your colleagues?
That's a great question. And I think an important thing to note at the moment is we do not have management at my current store location. Our store manager was let go from the company. And since then, Starbucks has flown in what they are calling support managers, which are managers from across the country to come into our stores to work with us and also, frankly, to surveil us. And those have been the methods of communication in which we have to go to advocate for ourselves. However, that's slightly uncomfortable as, you know, these managers, for the most part, have never visited Buffalo, New York, and they haven't worked in our Buffalo, New York district. So it's difficult to feel represented by managers flown in from corporate who don't know the specific Buffalo barista experience.
Colleen, do you know anyone who is currently a member of a union?
I do. I am very honored and lucky to have many friends who are studying to become teachers, who are entering the teachers union, and also family friends who are teachers who are in a union.
What are you hearing from people about the importance of joining a union and organizing, and why do you want to join one?
That's a good question. I think what I've mainly heard about organizing for a union is just simply having a seat at the table to advocate for yourself, knowing that your benefits are negotiated in a contract by baristas for baristas that represent your interests. I think that's the main reason that I want to organize a union for Starbucks. I understand that baristas have specific needs and wants, and who better to advocate for those than ourselves?
Do you all talk about the massive disconnect between CEO pay and worker pay and just growing inequality in this country? Earlier in the show, we mentioned that in 2020, Starbucks CEO Kevin Johnson took home almost $15 million in salary and stocks, according to Restaurant Business Online. And in 2019, he was given a $50 million bonus based on the shareholder return performance between 2019 and 2022. And then Starbucks just recently announced that workers will finally make $15 an hour and more if they've been there for longer than 2 years, right?
Yes, that's correct. So we definitely do talk about that inequality between, you know, the CEO pay and our average barista. And while, of course, I think that increasing wages for baristas is never a bad thing. Starbucks had 50 years to increase our wages, and we didn't see that wage increase until we began to unionize. And I think that's something that's very important to note.
Have you felt any pressure from management to stop organizing, or, you know, any pressure from management on anti-union efforts?
Oh, absolutely, Rose. I would say that I feel that pressure every single day that I go into work. Like I said, these support managers give sort of a culture of feeling like we can't openly discuss unionization on the floor. They also have been policing us for specific violations that were never previously implemented. For example, dress code. I go into work every single day wondering if I'm going to be met with a new dress code rule that had never previously been mentioned or enforced that is now going to be used to kind of demoralize our baristas on the floor. And it's very difficult to go in every day and meet these anti-union efforts. I think another thing that Starbucks has been doing in the Buffalo area to stifle our union organization is the regular holding of anti-union meetings, in which we're sat down by these support managers and also members of upper level corporate and told verbatim, we hope that you vote no. Starbucks has also been using emergency text and email services meant only to be used in times of utmost emergencies to instead text and email us once again with anti-union propaganda asking us to vote no. And after a while, you know, it's really hard to go into work every day and do your job, smile, make those customer connections and connect with your partners when you constantly feel like you're just being met with this anti-union rhetoric.
Wow. Well, Colleen, we have about 30 seconds left. So it sounds like morale has taken a hit, but at the same time, you're all really empowered by this successful effort to unionize at least one coffee shop so far.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's important to note that our desire to unionize does not come from a place of negativity towards Starbucks. It's because of love. We love this company. We love our baristas, and we're inspired by each other every single day to keep fighting for this union.
Mm. Colleen McCullen is a barista at a Starbucks location in Buffalo. Colleen has been working there since July and is organizing with the Starbucks Workers United movement. Colleen, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back in the new year to find out what is happening with your Starbucks and then many others across the country. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rose. I appreciate speaking with you.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.